It's so great to be here today with Brendan Graham Dempsey and Corey Barker. Those of you who listen to the channel often, you will remember Corey Barker from a previous conversation that we had about his book concerning arch disciplinarity. But today, Brendan is going to join us. And Brendan Graham Dempsey is a writer, poet, farmer, and systems thinker. And he's the director of Sky Meadow Institute, promoting systems thinking. And he's written a number of very intriguing works, and is kind of focused right now on this whole concept of metamodernism, which you could call postmodernism, but I'm sure we'll learn more about it today, which is productively bridging the divide between science and spirituality. And Corey Barker has a master's in social science and informatics, and he's working on a PhD with his research focus in applying big picture thinking to improved AGI design. And he is also, I think, currently president of the Arch Disciplinarity Research Center, which you can learn more about at arc.voyage. You can learn more about Brendan Graham Dempsey at his very robust website that has all sorts of interesting things on it, including his fictional writing, which really looks fascinating. I hope we'll have time to hear more about that. So today my hope is, since I talked to Corey previously about his book about arch disciplinarity, these two actually collaborated on that book, and I was hoping they could talk about how they met and began to work together on this and what part each of them played in writing of this book, and then have each of you talk a little bit about what you're exploring right now, and then maybe we can tie that back together again with some of the things that I talk about on the channel here, which it's basically the same kind of thing that you're talking about, but I approach it from a more pragmatic, simplistic level here. So very excited to hear from both of you. And maybe we'll start with Brendan, since you're the newbie on the channel.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate it. And in terms of, I guess how Corey and I met and started working together, my memory of it, which Corey is welcome to correct me on, was, you know, we'd been sharing the same kind of intellectual space for a little bit. My background, as we'll talk about in a bit, it sounds like, is in metamodernism, which is a frame of talking about, what comes after postmodernism. And there's a strong current in metamodern discourse that's been influenced by integral theory and big picture thinking, meta theory, these kinds of frameworks. And so I think Corey and I were sort of in a broader kind of intellectual scene in which there were a lot of shared conversation partners and people exploring similar kinds of topics. And so eventually, I think it was, Corey reached out. We had a chat and a conversation and saw a lot of deep alignment in our ways of thinking. And then over time, after a couple of conversations, Corey invited me to participate in the Arch Disciplinary Research Center that he'd gotten going, and that kind of continued to broaden my engagement with meta theory and arch theory and these sort of big pictures and theories of everything and the synthesis of those. It was just a really delightful field to deepen into, and I've been really enriched by that. So that's sort of where things got going. And then as part of that, the work that came out of the center, and that book that you've mentioned, I contributed some aspects around the metamodernism, section on that book and maybe a couple other things, but, Corey was definitely really the spearhead, kind of point person for that. So I can really only take minimal credit. And so that was a really wonderful, again, contribution that Corey's offered us with that, work on arch disciplinarity. And, it's just been a delight to also just get to know him and be friends and conversation partners. So, that's my take.
So Corey?
Yeah, that's my memory as well. Brendan just had such a way with words, being able to communicate about the big picture spaces with so much clarity. And that's really what sort of like prompted me to inquire him to start having conversations. But in terms of the foundations of arch disciplinarity book, Brendan, he mostly wrote like the entire chapter on the pre-modern, modern, postmodern, metamodern, archmodern topics. And yeah, but there was a lot of other people who contributed to that as well, writing in different sections. But yeah, I don't really have anything further to add on that topic. Yeah, it sounds accurate.
Well, in the introduction I just did, it sounded like you're doing something about artificial general intelligence. Are you still working on that in your PhD research?
Yeah, so how can I summarize without monologuing for 30 minutes on it? Well, I would say, like, in summary, so the current models that we have right now are LLMs, like large language models, and they work based on tokenization and statistical inference. So they basically they generate sentences one word at a time by, taking a token sequence and then trying to predict what the most likely next word is going to be. And, they're getting more advanced, and they're quite good. But the thing is that they don't really think like people do. They don't follow the same step-by-step transitional procedure in constructing ideas. And so part of the AGI project that I've been working on over the last year is actually programming in developmental psychology, making it like computable functions so that we can get programs that actually go through the procedure of thinking like people do. And another part of it is that in LLMs, the way that their ontologies are is kind of a mess. They don't really have knowledge structured in the way that knowledge is structured in people. And so, like in big picture spaces, there are these transdisciplinary theory of everything unification frameworks. And the authors of these frameworks attempt to fit together all human knowledge into coherent systems that are based on the natural relations of knowledge, in terms of like how knowledge is architected, and then the processes of intelligence that people go through as they're constructing. And so, yeah, well, part of my PhD dissertation is studying the ways that people do that, and then doing conversions over into constructing a framework for computation that emulates, like I was talking about before, the transitional developmental process, but also emulates the knowledge structures, like the architectures themselves, which I suppose, in conclusion to all this, I would say you get more efficient systems that require less energy to run. And you can trace back how conclusions are derived. And I know, like, OpenAI, has some methodologies that they're using that has, like, that goes through some sort of thinking procedure, but it's not informed by developmental psychology. And if you read over the steps that it goes through, it's just not there yet. Which isn't to bash OpenAI. We all see how awesome it is, but it's not quite at the AGI level. And Sam Altman has already, communicated that in interviews, that he's aware of the fact they're not there yet. So yeah,
Well,
that's.
what you just brought up is really fascinating to me about this idea of how we stack our knowledge systems in the human realm. And for a long time, I've thought about this and I've tried to find language to put around it. So maybe both of you could help me with this idea that, when you're a child, you learn maybe the basics of adding and subtracting and multiplying, and you learn the basic ideas of, in fifth grade, maybe you learn the basic ideas of the three parts of government. And so you have these kind of foundational things in each domain. And then as time goes on, you kind of come back around and you add a little bit more on that stack, and time you add a little bit more on that stack. It seems to me that each one of those stacks is kind of building some sort of a framework inside of our apparatus here that has a little like Velcro attachments on it. So when the next bunch of information or knowledge or wisdom floats around, it hooks on to those things that fit into that particular framework. Like my master's was in linguistics, and one of the things that they taught us in linguistics is that infants actually have the capacity to learn any language, obviously, but when they start babbling, they're babbling phonemes and sounds from every language. And then as they learn your language, then it reduce the number of phonemes that they're babbling reduces down to the one only the ones that they need for your language. So they lose some of the other like guttural sounds that may be in some other language. And that in a sense, you have a little black box so that if you grow up in a multilingual household, you're hearing all these different languages. But when the child begins to speak, they have already separated those languages out in their mind so they can speak English to the English mother, Chinese to the Chinese father. You know, if there's some other language, they so the little black box does all this sorting for them. How does that happen, right? But I think it's the same thing that there's when we're born, we already have this little set of Velcro connections, and then all the knowledge that comes in kind of naturally sorts into domains in us. I mean, that's kind of the way I'm thinking about it. I don't know developmental psychology, so I might be off on that a lot, but there is some way in which we have some sort of a matrix or scaffold or something that's in the brain that's already functional before we start learning. Do you have terminology for that?
I can start and then hand it to you, Brendan. I mean, you wrote a book, literally wrote a book on universal learning process. So,
Oh, wow, I hit the right guys then.
Carl Jung talked about like archetypes of the collective unconscious, how the brain autonomously assembles ideas on its own. Like it has its own natural way that it does it. And you know, like he talked about things like the anima and the animus and the shadow and the trickster and things like that. But there are other kinds of like archetypal structures in terms of how our minds autonomously organize information. And that was actually one of the earlier thoughts I had that sort of like propelled me into thinking about, you know, universal classes of human experience. Which eventually led to notions of arches in the Foundations book. So in terms of like developmental psychology, well, I would make reference like, for example, like dynamic skill theory, because in dynamic skill theory, dynamic skill theory was proposed by a Harvard professor named Kurt Fischer. And I think he ran like the brain mind science department there for a decade or more, 2 decades maybe, maybe longer. But he had dynamic skill theory that this is what he proposed. And so you have like the first stage is like so it's a model of skills, how skills develop, and it's a domain general model, so it applies across any given content or any area of that a person could develop skills in. And the way it goes is that you have reflexes, our bodies just autonomously reacting to stimulus. And then there's sensory motor. So like with sensory motor, infant or a child begins to understand how to like use their body. And then that's usually where you get the sensory or you get the babbling going on, is they're learning how to sort of like control their different systems towards, you know, different purposes, whether that's learning how to speak or learning how to wiggle their fingers, you know, pick things up and things like that. And then there's like the representational skills. And so what happens is that people like children will, in this, I say people first and then children because, you know, we can always return back and redevelop in different domains. But there's like a pairing. So there's like pairing between concepts and actions. And then this is where you get pairing concepts and words. And you know, there's this sort of like procedure that happens with everybody. It's universal, where you have pairing meanings with words, and then you have combining words together into simple sentence propositions, and then being able to combine the propositions together with other propositions into like paragraphs of statements. So that sort of like covers the ground of like what you're describing there to an extent. And then just in short terms, then there's abstraction. So it's doing like quantification or like generalization across representations, which makes it easier for us to conceptualize and communicate across swaths of information, being able to like reduce it down to generalizations, which can have problems because people can stereotype or over under generalize. But when people get really good at doing it, then they move on to principled skills. And then that's when people create rules that hold across abstract systems of understanding. And when people synthesize those principles together, then we get like paradigmatic thinking. And then this is when we get like the big domains of, academic research. People, have like schemas for psychology or neuroscience or sociology or physics and things like that. And development continues, but in any case, dynamic skill theory is I think like a really good domain general framework to use to sort of like, introduce people to the concept of developmental psychology. And to hand it off to Brendan, the last thing I'll say is there are universal patterns in as people go from one stage of development to the next, and then these are reflected in nature, such that perhaps intelligence in humans reflects larger cosmic processes. It's just the human version of it that comes through ourselves. So with that, I'll hand it to you, Brendan.
Yeah, no, that was a great kind of setup for things I would have brought in here as well. Yeah, I mean, that book that Corey mentioned is called A Universal Learning Process, and it's part of a broader series. But one of the things I'm trying to show there is this kind of universal kind of learning algorithm that, and here I'm drawing on the work of many, many thinkers. So I'm really just synthesizing some big picture models that other folks have been using to talk about this. But it's a very compelling and I think very convincing idea that when we look at the adaptive complexity that we see all over the place, what we're really looking at is a sort of coupling of an agent in its environment or to its environment that's suggestive of a deep learning or a knowledge acquisition going on. And so we can see this happening at different levels of evolution, where in a sense, information about the environment is sort of getting encoded in, let's say, the genome of an eagle in the shape of its wing and how that reflects, aerodynamic principles, or the way that a fish is, seems optimally sort of adapted to be in water, that there's a kind of pairing there or a fit that comes through a matching of the information from the environment and the information of the entity in a kind of adaptive way that you can think of in terms of knowledge increase, knowledge acquisition. And so in some senses, what we see through broader evolutionary processes is a kind of learning algorithm, a learning updating process in which information is sort of being encoded in this way. And so what we do as humans is a version of that. And there are universal principles that kind of guide this mechanistically, that is to say, in terms of the mechanisms employed here. So one of the, if not the most key or chief aspect of this, is something called variation and selective retention, which is, a kind of core evolutionary principle. When we see the diversification of a species and then the winnowing that the selection pressures of the environment cause, you're getting this sort of flourishing and then a paring down, and then based off of that paring down, a further flourishing and then a paring down. So there's this iterative process that's using things that are sort of building up their complexity and being sort of filtered out by means of a filtration mechanism of what's adaptive and what's not. And those kinds of dynamics show up in human learning in a very big way, at multiple levels. So to use your example, there are a couple of ways in which the acquisition of language is sort of like that, right? You start out with babbling, which is sort of just, a kind of groping or a trial and error. You're throwing out a bunch of different things, but a certain phoneme is going to land with your Chinese speaking father, right? Or a certain phoneme is going to land with your Chinese speaking mother. And through an iterative process back and forth, you then start to carve out, as it were, a subset of all the phonemes that you might have been babbling. And some of them are selectively retained, and the others, you could say go extinct in a kind of evolutionary sense. So you then get a filtration of this variation into a selected subset that becomes the basis for further complexification. And so what Corey was mentioning with dynamic skill theory is it gets really chiefly at this, which is this notion of complexification, of hierarchical complexification, which is you have an element, you bring them together, and then their kind of synthesis forms a cohesive whole that operates at a new level by means of the integration or the coordination of these. And now you've got a new unit, and then you can find another thing at that level and integrate or coordinate those, and so on and so forth. So through this process, you could say you pare down from the vast variation of, say, phonemes into a subset that then becomes the basis of these different languages that are being developed and that someone can gain facility with. But it is adaptive, and it's in response to the environment, right?
So, like in a sense, the level up above you is like a trainer. The level up is your trainer.
Well, in some sense, right? Like a parent who's maybe already proficient in a language, and then the child who's learning the language, you could call them the trainer, but they're setting they're in the developmental language, you would say they're scaffolding them through this process of language acquisition. But yeah, I mean, and it's interesting as well, because if you don't have, say, a Chinese speaking father in the house, then you're probably not going to pick up on, I mean, you're not going to pick up on that set of phonemes and on that sort of linguistic trajectory. So it's really in terms of, what is an adaptive response for the entity in its environment to kind of develop certain skills in context. But however specific the skills might be, they do follow certain universal learning principles that can be applied to language or other kinds of skill acquisitions. So there's a lot more I could say about that. But yeah, again, there's so much there.
I'll add one more thing. Maturana and Varela, they wrote a book on autopoiesis and cognition, which I think is a related concept here. So you get like couplings between elements, and then they form systems. And you get this sort of like recursive iterative feedback. And so everything is creating it, like all the elements in the system are creating themselves. They're perpetuating their existence together simultaneously, in a kind of a mutuality. And this concept, you can relate this to like logic, like we have premises and then we relate the premises together and we form a conclusion. And a conclusion is going to rely on those premises. You can't remove the premises or conclusion comes undone. I think you can also relate it to evolution as well. You have different species that exist in an environment, and they are bound in that environment, and they have developed like evolutionarily or through adaptation to that environment, and the environment defines them, they define the environment. And yeah, it's the same thing like with semiotics and a home. Children are brought up with certain kinds of like signs and meaning, appended to different sounds, and then they are bounded into that system. And so yeah, like you can have like top level coordination downward, but then the child is going to be influencing back upward, and it's going to create this sort of feedback mechanism. The thing I would leave this topic off on would be what's really interesting to me is that humans, for some reason, are different. Like all the other species on the planet are perfectly fitted for their environments, and they don't behave beyond what their environments would require of them. But people, for whatever reason, our brains are built for space. Our brains can go way beyond our environments, and so I won't make any too big of propositions about that, but just like the observation of it is very, very fascinating to me.
Well, that it's so funny because when you were saying we are not perfectly fitted to our environment like other animals, I thought the next thing out of your mouth was going to be something like we are adversarially related to our environment, and I think that's what motivates our growth, right, in so many ways. But when you said we are made for space, a thousand light bulbs went off in so many different directions. And I'd like to have you guys talk about what that actually means. Because, I mean, one of the thoughts that sprang out to me from that was before, Corey, you and I talked a lot about boundaries and the importance of boundaries and how they function. And boundaries are necessary because we don't have them. We really don't have any creative motivation. But at the same time, we live in this massively large space, right? So, yeah, how do you work that out in your head? So, Brendan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Gosh, well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways that this could go, and I'm interested to hear more what Corey's thinking about this. I guess I would say a couple of things. One is, I think to some degree it's a difference in degree, maybe also, and a difference of kind between us and animals. I think that again, these deeper mechanisms are at play across the board. So I think that, those limits, that antagonism, I think is the word that you use. That is the basis of growth for all kind of, at least, I would say all learning entities in some way. That's what drives adaptation, right? If something were, just endlessly pliable, there would be no need or any kind of, pressure to adapt or conform. Or so a lot of this all depends on hitting up against certain boundaries or limitations or constraints in your environment, and then that being the means by which you grow. And I think that dynamic is true of animals, but it's particularly and uniquely true of humans in a specific way. And the way I tend to think a lot about that unique aspect is the way that we add on top of this process a kind of symbolic information linguistic component that allows our minds to go off into space, whereas in a, let's say a I don't know a for some reason I was looking for an animal, and the one that came to mind was those big dragon lizards. Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know.
Komodo,
Yeah, a
the
Komodo
Komodo.
dragon. I don't know why that, but so a Komodo dragon, lacking language is going to be limited to the more concrete realities that they're engaging with. And so it's a lot more, well, let's say even entirely about physical constraints and the constraints imposed by a natural environment and that sort of a thing. Now, what is kind of special about humans is that all that's going on as well. We are animals, but we're also this other thing by virtue, in large part, of our linguistic capacity to then basically reduplicate those learning dynamics, but through a new medium, which is language. And so we learn language in very much the same way, and we acquire concepts through very much the same way as these other learning processes, but in that different substrate. And that is what allows us to reach into entirely sort of trans concrete phenomena in our heads, right? Like we can, you, we, and this gets back to what Corey was talking about with dynamic skill theory and the hierarchical complexification process, which is something unique to humans, because what we can do and what we do is we take concrete representational phenomena, such as other animals might, be able to cognize, but then we're able to coordinate that into mappings and then systems and then these systems of these systems. And that's what actually generates abstraction. So a notion like truth or goodness or, infinite space or something like this is an abstraction that's based on lower level concrete representations, but through successive coordinations, they've reached a level of generality that we're able to think at that scope. And this is something kind of unique to us. So to go back to the issue of our minds being, kind of habitable or oriented towards space, I think what I read there is that we are uniquely capable of having the kinds of abstract and let's say formal reasoning capacities that can expand our internal models of reality out into the farthest reaches of space in a way that is very unique, and that's really predicated on language and our ability to manipulate ideas in terms of symbols. So this is what basically is the difference between adapting to our environment and versus the ability to seek out different environments and sort of in a sense be able to effectively evolve or adapt to or work in those very different spaces because we have this additional layer of like ingenuity and invention and problem-solving capacity at this kind of abstract level that can facilitate that so that now we can send probes and people potentially to Mars, right? And they can be operating in that space and dealing with the problems, the environmental problems in that space using these skills. So that's how I read that idea.
What you were saying about the adversarial element of it as well. Yeah, so people they sort of like, so with the capacity to think beyond our environments, it's also true that we have to be thinking in relationship to our environments themselves, obviously. Like that autopoetic thing that I was talking about before, like we are still part of the world. We're still in it. We're part of, social systems, and those social systems are part of larger social systems, which are tied into all kinds of different institutions with lots of people trying to do lots of different things, sometimes mutually and sometimes competing over, who gets what to be a certain way. So with all of that going on, I do think that it relates to maybe we can kind of use this as a segue over to talking about metamodernism, because there is a sort of like there are different stages of sociocultural evolution or like cultural logics that people go through, and there are natural behavioral forms innate in the mechanisms of how the world works across all the different building blocks. And in order for us to successfully maintain, we have it requires a certain kind of certain kinds of values and certain kinds of rules that we have to follow in order for us to maintain the equilibrium. And we can only build we can only advance and progress on the stability of the previous equilibriums. And so I think a lot of the problems that we're facing is reflective of, because every person has to go through stages of development. Like you can't skip a stage and like leap forward. But everybody has to go through the transitions, and both on an individual level, also like on a family level, on a cultural level, in a social level and a community, and then you can just keep going upwards with, municipalities and states into entire nations into the international stage. And so there needs to be a certain stage of development in order for people to coordinate appropriately. Like you can't have a universal culture. And you can't have a culture with specific values unique to that culture and enforce it on an entire nation without having problems, because that on the national scale is a higher level of coordination, and it's going to consist of different cultures. And then people come together, and then on their overlap, then they share in common things, and then they use those as the basis of having their democracy. And in order to be able to perform those tasks, a person has to be at a certain stage of development in order to do it. And in this sort of like universal learning process, there like Brendan was saying, like there are universal like transitions that happen. And like so you have like some sort of stable equilibrium of the way that a person is thinking or doing or feeling, being in the world, and something new gets introduced, and it can create this sort of destabilization. And what do people do? Like either they're going to outright reject it, say that they're wrong, and try to crush it, or they're just going to totally put it out of their mind and ignore it, or they're going to see it as another way that people are in the world, and then they're going to look into the they're going to want to understand the causalities for why it is the way it is, maybe look for some of the positive things that are in it, and then do evaluation to figure out, okay, well, maybe there are some things about this that are okay, and maybe there are some things that aren't. But then what about my way of being and doing? Maybe there are some things about this other way that are improved over the way that I am. And then people oscillate. They'll bounce between one way of thinking or doing and another. And if people continue the transitional process, eventually they'll break them down into their parts and then reassemble a higher level of coordination, sort of like an intermeshing at a higher level of equilibrium. And you can see this like in democracies. Like, this is what we do. It's like we have lots of different people with lots of different beliefs, and then we look at what we all share in common for the common good, and then we try and make rules that are based on that. So people have the greatest amount of freedom to be who they want and believe what they want, but also we have like standards that we all agree to. So when we're talking about like bigger picture issues, I think people struggle with being able to do that. You know, the knowing how to put do the push and the pull in healthy ways, you know, when to stand ground and when to compromise on issues. Like, people are always going to be learning how to do that. We're always going to be incrementing slowly towards having better social systems for it. But as we do that, we go through these different sociocultural stages. And yeah, there's like an overall trend over time of the history of the world, but it's not just like an era thing. Like, different new cultures can develop and they might go through the same stages in that sort of a micro version. So I guess I'll hand that to you, Brendan, unless Karen, you had anything you wanted to add.
Well, I can always jump in later. So, Brendan, you were gonna bounce, take that and bounce into metamodernism.
Yeah, so I think one of the ways that metamodernism can be understood is as a developmental stage at a sociocultural level. And there's a notion there that, as Corey was saying, it's not just about changes, like eras, like now everyone, you know, wears pink and now they all wear green, and, you know, it's all just at a kind of a lateral level. There's actually some degree of vertical growth or change as well. And how does that get considered or even measured? So one of the ways that I talk about this in my book on metamodernism is to think about really these broad cultural codes or epochs that are really genuinely engaging with kind of new ideas as systems that are able to reflect on what has been, take them as an object, critique them, and sort of transcend them to some other level, and that there's a natural process there that you can see unfolding. Oh, there he is. I've got this little they're like little ladybug on me. Well, they're not real ladybugs, they're these invasive terrible bugs instead. Anyway, I'll let them hang out there. Yeah, the idea is something like this, right? I mean, metamodernism comes after postmodernism, and in some ways is grappling with and trying to move beyond postmodernism, but not just outright reject it. Somehow try to bring into synthesize, integrate with what it recognizes as genuine insights or, you know, additions of postmodernism, but maybe to avoid the impasses or the limits or what was not working. And this is, in some senses, what defines anything as being metamodern. If you were to say, oh, I'm talking about ideas that just all out reject postmodernism, then by definition, it's not a moving through and beyond, it's just a move away from. And I think that when we look at the progression of different sort of cultural epochs in this way, we see that there's always something that in some ways gets carried forward from what has been by means of reflection on what has been. So, you know, the kind of one of the biggest breaks is between so-called modernity and the pre-modern world, and you get a very kind of you get a moment, a cultural moment in which people are self-consciously reflecting on pre-modernity, and they're distinguishing themselves from it, and they're saying, we're not this. But that requires being removed from it enough to take it as an object of analysis and be able to say, this is a thing, but we're in some ways now not doing something along those lines. And so that's something you can't do when you're in it, but you have to have enough, in a sense, behind you that you can look to and say, ah, this characterizes a certain way of being, a certain mode, a certain, and then different terms are used for these kinds of structures, whether they're epistemes or ways of knowing or, worldviews or epochs, these kinds of terms. There's different ways of slicing that pie. But as you look back and you're able to reflect, then you can do the kinds of transitional moves that Corey's describing a little bit. You can, you're confronted by the possibility of, do I embrace any of this? Do I just reject it outright? Do I oscillate back and forth between, oh, maybe some of this is right, some maybe some not. Maybe this leads to a lot of confusion, maybe some kinds of relativism. And then at a certain point, there is this kind of higher order coherence in which ideas from before are able to remesh by reorganizing at sort of a higher level that's able to bring that forward, what works, and then leave behind, some of the aspects that were genuinely not adaptive, at this higher level of complexity. So
That's
that's a
a perfect description of culture shock, of the culture shock. You go to a new country. I lived in Japan for 3 years, so you go and everything is interesting and fascinating, and you're on this high. And then as you begin to see all the differences and where things that you can't accept about their culture, you start falling down into the pit. And then when you're down at the bottom, in order to get back up the other way again, you have to start thinking. Now you've been there long enough that you have a backward look at your own culture, and you can start seeing the deficits in your own culture from the benefits of the new culture, and then that helps drive you back up to the top of the U. But what I noticed when I was in Japan was that it was more like a W, and it was actually more like a WW because you keep getting to a new high where, okay, now I've integrated this thing, and then something new comes along, and it's, oh, I had no idea, and so you keep falling down in this pit and coming back up, which is really just a picture of the way life works in our developmental process, which, and it's the way marriage works. Everything works that way. And what's really so sad is when people are at the bottom and they give up there, instead of recognizing this is just part of the process before you drive up the next hill,
Yeah, well, and real quick on that point, I would suggest too that one way of conceiving that WWWW ongoing is maybe not just as a horizontal process that's just up and down and like cyclical, but it's somehow maybe kind of spiraling in some way. I like
Absolutely.
for example, when I to use something from my own travels, when I went to, I think it was Norway, at first I thought, oh wow, Norway's, everything I'd heard about, their everything, let's just say the reputation of Norway was sort of like, oh, they're so great, they're so grand, and they've got this and they've got that. And I go there, and in some senses, that's immediately confirmed. But then later on, and by the way, I was like, this was maybe I was 20 years old when I was traveling, so I was a bit young, and so I didn't have a lot of money. So I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'll go to this local McDonald's and I'll get a burger or something. And I go in there, and just to get a meal at McDonald's was the equivalent of like $25, which actually in today's language maybe isn't as shocking, but in 2010, that was like, wow, this is so much more. And then you'd go into a grocery store and you'd be like, why is the food so expensive? Expensive. And then I started thinking, oh, well, maybe this vision that I had is counterbalanced by, this darker thing that no one was talking about, which is that this is a really unaffordable place and this and that. So then I'm kind of down there. But then I realized in retrospect, well, this is interesting because this is actually part of a broader systemic structure that maybe these things are directly related, right? Rather instead of, oh, it's so great, or no, it's not because, everything's so expensive. It's like maybe these are. Everything can be really great in some ways because things are so expensive, right? And then that to think that you actually have to have a systemic frame where you're actually able to situate those two things together, coordinate them, and see how those two things are not, non-arbitrarily coordinated. And in doing that, you haven't just jumped back. you've actually jumped up. You've gotten a bigger vantage on what's going on. And this process will continue, right? So that maybe then you're saying, oh, well, I guess it's all worth it structurally because of this. But then maybe you see another aspect of the structural element of, Norwegian society that isn't great. And you're like, oh, well, and then you have to coordinate that. So this is kind of those processes that Corey was getting at earlier. And the point would be that it's not just sort of moving anywhere, it's moving in a particular direction. And when you can see that these things are kind of getting increased levels of in complexity and in scale, you're actually getting new added benefits. That's actually a growth or a development, giving you new advantages and advantages from which to operate that are, increasing your equilibrium and your adaptive capacities in new ways. So, yeah.
So I'm assuming that both of you are familiar with this concept that's making the rounds at a lot of different disciplines and levels, called the free energy principle, which I believe was first proposed by Carl Friston. Could you talk a little bit about how that fits into the whole concept of both metamodernism and archdisciplinarity?
I have some thoughts. Brendan, do you have any?
I have lots of thoughts, but I also was just went on a whole ramble spiel. So if you want to go ahead and start, I can take it after you.
Well, my understanding of the free energy principle is that it's actually the use up all the energy principle. So it's about like not letting anything go to waste. So when we're talking about free energy principle, usually the way that it's described is like through what I would call like transduction or transductive networks. So you have like input, throughput, output systems. And then those systems are trying to run as efficiently as possible. So for me, part of it, okay, so part of me relates this specifically to when I say transduction, I'm making reference to an arch theory of my own called architectonic simulation. And in this framework, basically, what I attempted to do was look across all these different transdisciplinary architectural and processual frameworks and derive the common characteristics that they share in common. And so the way it goes is that you have, and this is part of my dissertation, and there's some of this stuff briefly in the Foundations of Archdisciplinarity book, but I haven't formally published on this yet. I did a couple of YouTube lecture videos on architectonic simulation some years back, but so I'll just like give like a very quick rundown. So there's like automation, universal process of automation, which is all about like cause and effect. So like something happens and then it has a triggering effect for something else to happen and that has a triggering effect on something else. And then you get transduction, and transduction is when you have these different cause effect chains that form stable systems where they create a boundary space and then something happens on the surface of that space or on some sort of receptor, and then it creates a cascade through or the interior. And it can be a direct line or it can split. So like different strengths of signals can cause different outputs on the effectors on the other side of the system. And transduction as a process takes place like in our neurons. So, like we have neurons with lots of dendrites on them that are connecting with other neurons, and it creates a plethora of different possibilities of connections. And so you get different combinations of sensory input that's sending off signals through systems across the neurons. And then this is what I would call like the universal process of concretion. So you get like you get signals that get sent through the transductive network. So if you think, for example, like in our brains, and all the signals get fired off and it creates a state through the system. And then this is where we create like a representation. We can have a representation of something. So as it continues to fire off over and over and over again, for example, if we're looking at an object and it's not moving and the sensory impressions recursively, iteratively are firing off over and over and over, and it forms like a very concrete image, like impression in our nervous system. So we have a lot of these systems going on in us all the time. we have our autonomic nervous system and our sympathetic nervous system that are balancing with each other, and we're able to operate in our environments. And then we get these, we have experiences happen to us. And so our brains are attempting to, they're attempting to find like the most optimal way to process information. And I think this is where like the free energy principle comes in, is it's an attempt to define how our brains, and I know people extend it in other things as well. It's not just like in brains, but like how systems are basically like attempting to operate towards efficiency. And so I'll just kind of stop there and hand it to you, Brendan.
Yeah, and I would add, I mean, so the notion there that we're working with is really something like surprise, right? So the free energy principle in Friston's framing is this notion of something like a predictive processing, that when we go out in the world, we're working with a certain set of expectations, this kind of world map or model that we've built up. And we are really hoping that it holds, right? I mean, if I walk out my front door and actually the steps are gone, I'm gonna tumble down, I'm gonna hurt myself. That's not good. Okay, so like that'd be a big surprise. And so we don't want that. They're usually bad for us in terms of maintaining our viability as organisms when we're suddenly shocked by this thing we weren't expecting. And so what we want to do ideally is continually update our model to be in greater conformity with what we're actually experiencing, and this will minimize the free energy. This will minimize the surprise between our expectation and reality, as it were. And so this is a great way also of thinking of what we've already been talking about in terms of learning, in terms of the pushing back of reality and what drives growth, right? Because in Piagetian terms, there's these notions called assimilation and accommodation, right? That we'll tend to assimilate to our own established categories, something that we experience, unless it just doesn't fit. It just doesn't work. We're forced to kind of accommodate. It's like, okay, I'm seeing an animal. It's not a moose. It's not a deer. I'm like trying to fit it in the pre-existing blocks and assimilate it, but it's not working. I'm like, okay, no, this is some new animal I've just never seen before. I'm forced to accommodate to what's happening here. And this is basically that what drives the differentiation that then leads to integrations and so on and so forth. This is what drives hierarchical complexification, and that's learning. If we are always, in a sense, meeting our expectations about reality, then we're actually not learning. What we are always trying to do is, yeah, update our understanding of reality to be in greater conformity so that we can minimize that free energy or that surprise. And when kind of understood that way, we kind of see again another kind of inferential process at work that is a deep learning algorithm or mechanism that's driving, well, again, at multiple scales and in multiple levels, certainly at the individual level, but arguably, in other contexts as well, where, let's say, I don't know, maybe something even like geopolitics, right? Like, oh, okay, well, if, we're going to do this policy and no one's going to get upset by that, and it's just going to be fine. Oh, wait, all of a sudden they're, this country's upset about that. Well, we were expecting that. And then you're forced to accommodate, you're forced to shift your, and so there are kind of these continual learning dynamics that are unfolding across scales. And one could argue that something like metamodernism is an extension of the same kind of logic, right? So you get modernity, let's say, with all of its ideas, and it's like, ah, yes, this is the way forward. And then the postmoderns come along, and they're like, well, wait, what about this, 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 and this? And then they're posing all these problems or challenges to a model, and then you need to update the model if those challenges are legit, right? So then what do you do? Well, you've got to shift. And so in some ways, the movement from modernity to the postmodern is a shifting of paradigms or of models to try to rethink and reorganize thought in light of new information. And then similarly, when the postmodern paradigm starts to show all these holes, then similarly, you've got to reorganize things. And hopefully, again, at not just any level, but at a higher level that's able to account for more of this information more comprehensively. So there are ways of integrating something like free energy principle with Kuhn's paradigm changes and, notions of cultural evolution, which are things that I find really exciting.
Yeah, and for anybody who's watching that is still not clear on some of these terms that we're using, like the pre-modernity basically defines like religiosity, I would say. like people who have faith-based beliefs, with no specific like concrete empirical basis to prove it. And this is not like a value judgment on pre-modernism. It's just, like people, for example, like read a holy text. They weren't there. They didn't see it. There's nothing they can do to verify it empirically to prove that it's true, to other people. Hence why there's so many different religions. And then modernity was more about science, or it is more about science. It's so kind of relating it to what you were saying, Brendan. It's saying, but well, wait a minute. Like, so this, I see this observably, empirically happening, but it's not like it kind of contradicts this other like religious belief I had, or I'm not sure how to reconcile the two. And then, going from modernity into postmodernity, that's when you, so science basically, not just science, but I would just say like any empirical approach, or like very structured methodology for performing a task, acquiring knowledge, or data, you have like a particular way you do it, but then it just turns out that there's a lot of different methodologies. So you could be scientific in a lot of different ways, but then people come to different conclusions, they come to different results. And so that's what postmodern is all about, is it's basically saying, well, so we follow these different methodologies, but how do I know that mine is right and yours is wrong, or how do I know yours is right and mine is wrong? Like there's no basis to do it, because if we apply methodology to figure it out, then we're just now applying another methodology. So everything feels very relativistic, in that sense. And so metamodernism basically says, actually, we can organize all these methodologies. We can organize all these different ways of knowing, and we can create a super system of understanding. And then when we do that, it turns out that there's patterns in how people think, how people structure their knowledge. And then this is when we get to that, the transdisciplinary theory of everything frameworks. So people figure out a way to fit together everything coherently. So all of those arguments that people have from the postmodern sensibility get organized into a larger superstructure of understanding, so that we can advance sense making. And so it's sort of like metamodernism takes the best of the previous stages of social evolution or cultural logic, and then it fuses it all together, while trying to not make the same mistakes. So it's to say, well, yeah, knowledge is relative, for example, and to an extent that's true, but it's also true what the modernists were saying, that there are things that are universally true. And the religiosity side, the universe is a mystery. Like this is true. And maybe there are truths to spirituality, but we can also combine that with science to understand it. They don't have to be separated. Like we can go together, fusing them together going into the future. And so metamodernism is a sensibility about the world that says, I don't know, Brendan, how would you define metamodernism in a nutshell?
Well, I mean, I think you're doing that was really good. I would agree with that. It is a notion that there's a multiple sets of perspectives that are that can be coordinated and can enhance our understanding of a more holistic picture. But at the same time, I think there's also the emphasis that this doesn't necessarily give us the total picture, right? This just enhances this process by which we get a greater vantage on things. And I think it's self-consciously aware that this is an ongoing process, and that those vantages ideally will themselves be superseded, right? So there expects to be something from the metamodern perspective, something after metamodernism that is, if it's doing this process, will identify the pitfalls of metamodernism, but also try to carry forward its, gains, right? But from a higher vantage. And that does then start to lead to this arch level that Corey talks about a lot in his work of where you're really moving beyond the sort of meta theory stances of meta modernism into this arch theoretical space of what Corey calls arch modernism, and I think that that's part of the picture of a kind of a meta modern perspective, which is that there's this continually unfolding, hopefully developing and advancing set of perspectives, but it avoids kind of that. A very totalizing, maybe totalitarian, instinct of like modernity to try to get the picture, the God's eye view, the view from nowhere, and all that. It acknowledges that all views are views from somewhere, but it doesn't end in relativism by saying so. It's actually able to say, all right, well, how do we get a bigger vantage on the whole scene by getting all these different perspectives and, sort of triangulating them all, as it were, and taking what is true from each of those. So that is a big part of a lot of the metamodern discourse, though not all. It's pluralistic itself.
Well, one thing I'd like to ask you, Brendan, and then I have a question for both of you. So the question for you, Brendan, is where would you say the turning point was in the 21st century where you think metamodernism sort of took hold? And then I have an adult daughter who's 30 years old, and she told me that her idea of post of metamodernism is Ted Lasso. And I'd like to have you both talk about Ted Lasso.
Sure.
You're familiar with it.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
let's start with the turning point.
I mean, the turning point, I think, is the early 21st century, sometime, early 2000s, you start to see this emergence of a new kind of art. And this kind of picks up steam, as you move into from the first decade into the second decade of the 21st century. I grew up even as a kid really interested in Wes Anderson movies, for example, but there was a whole kind of burgeoning scene in folk music with Sufjan Stevens and a lot of this kind of new earnestness and new sincerity showing up. And this is the cultural studies element of metamodernism where this term comes from originally, that really was putting its finger on this a lot. So in 2010, those scholars who were identifying this paradigm published their seminal essay on it. And of course, they were already speaking to a bunch of things that were already, happening in culture. The kind of meteoric popularity and rise of Barack Obama as a candidate of hope and change and all of this at sort of a political level and all the art and music and whatnot. So yeah, arguably, sometime in the let's say, around 2000 and thereabouts. And at the same time, this is also true with any of these kinds of paradigms that you can see kind of proto or intimations, of them in earlier contexts. Like a lot of postmodernism, arguably, people can find kind of gestures to already in the Dadaists and in the work of Marcel Duchamp and stuff like that, which was a generation or more earlier. So once you kind of have the rubric and the typology, you can go back and start saying, oh, this thing that was happening here a little bit earlier also kind of has some kind of intimations of what we would later call metamodernism. But I do think that for it to be genuinely metamodern in nature, it needs to be constructively responding to what had already then become established as postmodernism. And actually, linking all those ideas together, I think that you see already, even in the late 90s, a lot of people using various terms to talk about what I would call metamodernism under labels like reconstructive postmodernism or what's the other one? Productive postmodernism. There are a couple of thinkers that were using terms like this in academia who were, again, engaged in the same kind of process of like acknowledging what was coming out of postmodernism, but seeing the ways that that could go a little off the rails. So they were trying to respond to it productively and reconstructively. And I think all of that fits well into what becomes metamodernism. So the reason why, well, just then on the Ted Lasso front, and then feel free to take that over, Corey. I would say that that's a great example of this sensibility that these scholars were describing, which is this return to earnesty and sincerity within a context of irony and cynicism. So a lot of the metamodern works seem to betray both sensibilities simultaneously. They have what seems like this very postmodern, self-conscious, hyper-reflective, kind of cynical attitude that you'd expect from postmodern works, but they also have this kind of more earnest, sincere, idealistic element that you would, that might associate with modernity or even before. And so somehow they're operating simultaneously, or oscillating back and forth or something, was what these scholars were saying. And when you watch a show like Ted Lasso, you get something like that. It's not just this simplistically naive, leave it to Beaver kind of more modernist feel. It's a character who kind of has those values, but in a backdrop or against a backdrop of a lot of cynicism and more postmodern sensibility. And it's the dynamic interplay between those that makes it something new. That, like, actually, the reason why Ted Lasso is even more endearing than, say, the Leave It to Beaver family is because he's in this context that you get that foil and you get what he is sort of not. And I think that that's part of that metamodern move, is like recognizing all the reasons to be cynical and skeptical and this and that, and yet making some kind of affirmational, reconstructive, positive move anyway. So anyway, that'd be my take on that.
Yeah, Bill Tolbert, he wrote a book on action inquiry, and he has a stage model.
Action inquiry.
Action inquiry,
Action.
he put forth a stage model of managerial styles, and the stage that corresponds with metamodernism is. He called it the ironist stage. It's because, people, there's like a certain sensibility, I think. So meta modern sensibility is a sensibility. It's a kind of logic. It's a way of sense making, or holding a certain coherence about like what's going on. And it doesn't require like, having or holding a big picture theory of everything framework to be there. It's just a general sensibility in the transitional, dialectic of understanding how things are relating to each other. And I think the irony part is like a really important way of defining it, because it's showing that everything is related, and there's some sort of poetic recursive self-reference going on. That's cohering the disparities between the cynicism and sincerity in ourselves and in what we observe. So yeah, like I'm entirely in agreement with everything that you're saying about that, Brendan. Yeah. And at arch modernism, we can't really. So it's not like, in a sense, I feel like. So, like with metamodernism, we're basically, it's this is like the it's the first stage where we're able to see the whole trajectory. Like we have enough observations of different stages of development of these, social increments to be able to reflect on it and see that we're going in a vertical line. And yeah, sometimes we'll go back and redevelop, in different ways. It's linear and nonlinear at the same time. But I think it's important to just convey that it's the first social development stage where we can reflect on the whole trajectory. And it's important to say that because when we get to arch modernism, it now we're reflecting on different versions of metamodernism. We're able to see the different variations of expression for how people are in the space, and then start deriving the common characteristics across it in the same way that metamodern did that with postmodernism, and postmodern did that with modernism, and modernism did that with premodernism. And that none of them are better or worse than any of the others. I think I'm speaking for Brendan, and I think I'm speaking for everybody else, mostly everybody else, in the metamodern spaces, which is it's sort of like they all have their own functional usefulness. And not only do we all need to develop through them, but we all need to go back and redevelop through them in different ways, in different times of our life. So it's not like oh, you're metamodernist, you're metamodernist and now you're better than postmodernists. It's more like, well, no, there's like certain kinds of problems and you can't solve them without that sensibility.
Yeah,
And
I
then
would. Well, I would, and the only thing I would qualify that with slightly is just that one, there are impasses or limitations or problems that each of these kind of cultural codes brings up, right? So if you are, for example, as some people are, as I was, as I think many people experience, if you hit up against the kind of nihilism, let's say, that postmodernism tends to bring up, that can be very destabilizing and ultimately unhelpful and maladaptive for you, right? And so then there is this question of like, well, is there something past this that can kind of allow me to restructure my understanding such that I have a different vantage and this actually is helpful? And so I do think that there is that kind of benefit that comes from those higher vantages there. And the other thing about that too is that it is. It's contextual. It's relationship based in terms of a person in a context in an environment, right? So yeah, 2,000 years ago, actually maybe some kind of meta modern orientation would be maladaptive, right? But in a context such as ours, in which the complexity itself of our environment is ratcheting up, I think one could make a case that a more being able to more adequately attend to the complexity of the environment with a kind of world model and sensibility and understanding that that will offer certain adaptive capacities that are helpful, right? And so at the same time, because that is built up from all these other ways of being as well, it's not like it's an either or, it's always that both and so that's just some smaller aspects, but I agree. I think that anyone who wants to use these kinds of developmental models and ways of thinking to sort of like create this simple hierarchy of like, oh, people on the top are better, and or even saying that people are somewhere in this kind of thing is obviously not just dangerous and unhelpful, but it's kind of naive and doesn't deal appropriately with all the kind of nuance and complexity that these models are trying to bring our attention to. So yeah, I think we need to avoid that for sure.
Yeah.
I had just a couple of things I wanted to bring in here. One is that when you were talking about the shift from postmodernism to metamodernism in both of your discussions, the picture kind of came up to me that you need to get to the place in the trajectory of postmodernism where it has become kind of common in the whole cultural mindset. Because postmodernism really percolated up out of the academy back in the 70s, right? 70s, 80s, something like that. But it didn't really become a part of the whole culture until maybe in the 90s when we started in with all the relativism and all of that kind of thing. And then people didn't start using the term until maybe the late 90s. And then it became sort of like, well, we're the postmodern generation in the early 2000s. And by that time, we're probably at the end of postmodernism, but it has percolated through the whole culture so that we can go back and look at it, right, and determine that there needs to be something new. And this is when metamodernism comes along. And then they have to grapple with each other. And it sounds almost like a marriage. You have to get to know your partner before you can both, before you can come to this new accommodation. So that was just a picture that came to my mind. But the other thing I wanted to ask you guys about, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, and I would really love to have some help with understanding for myself what this principle actually is. Going back to the idea of the free energy principle, and I think this is connected to the free energy principle. It may not be, but some time ago, I heard a lecture by a woman physicist, Sharon Glotzer, and she was talking about some experiments that she had done with particles. She had developed a way to create synthetic nanoparticles, and they were running a lot of experiments to see what would happen if they put a lot of these synthetic nanoparticles in a space and then began removing space. And they remove space, and the more they remove, as soon as they get to a certain point of removing space, the particles manifest a crystalline structure and lock into this beautiful crystalline structure. And she said there was no manipulating done on the part of the experimenter. The only She said this happened solely on the basis of entropy. And as I was listening to her, I thought, well, no, actually, you did manipulate it because you were removing space. I mean, when you remove space, I mean, when you put something in a smaller and smaller, more confined environment, you've changed the boundary conditions, you've changed the amount of space, and each particle is trying to find its own place in there so that it has its maximum freedom in whatever configuration it's involved in, right? And it has it's trying to find its own maximum space that it can find, and in that, it turns into a crystalline structure somehow. But that said to me that, plus through the working of art, I've come to understand that boundaries are really essential for creative generation. If you don't have some boundary, you can't, you just don't even know where to start. There's too many options. So there's some space at which creative disequilibrium turns into a kind of a locked-in equilibrium from which there is no escape. And how does that work through all these different levels? How do we know where that space is? Because when we got into the political place where we have people locked into their little ideological silos, where, you know, this side has their set of parameters and they're not moving from their beliefs, and this other side has their own set. They've chosen an ideological space. They've chosen very tight boundaries within that space, almost to the point where they've ossified and there's no movement possible. But maybe just before that happened, there was enough space so there could have been some creative generation that would have allowed the two sides to talk to each other. So I think finding where that space is between equilibrium and disequilibrium is a pretty important thing. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, so there's a lot to all that. And by the way, if you haven't checked it out, highly recommend Alicia Hararo's book, Context Changes Everything, through
I
MIT
have her
Press.
other book, but I don't have that one. But
Oh,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I told, I mean, I wrote that down in my notebook. I wrote down in my notebook like 8 years ago, context is everything. And
Yeah.
then I started thinking about it, and I started thinking, no, it's not everything.
Well,
Because
I
if
don't think,
it
yeah,
weren't
she's
everything,
not
a
making
lot of
that.
other things fall out of that.
Yeah.
Anomaly is essential.
Yeah, I
So
don't.
okay, go on with what you were going to
Well,
say.
I was just, yeah, I mean, so she, that her book, she's not making the actual claim that context is everything, but it colloquially to mean different ways of thinking about causation and through notions of constraint and boundary and entropy and all the things that you're just talking about and how they relate to degrees of freedom. I would say that I would have to know more about the specific study that you're talking about to know what the physics were that were going on to actually speak intelligently to that. But I would say that there's an element in which, well, two things that I would speak to there is one is a highly condensed crystal structure is actually something very ordered. And it's very interesting that entropy can produce order, but it does so in instances where, yeah, the generation of entropy, in a sense, is itself done more efficiently. If an ordered structure is created, and these are called dissipative systems or dissipative structures, where like the gyre that forms in your bathtub, for example, is an example of order being created in a sense to dissipate a gradient and to create energy more efficiently. So this might be an example of that, where you get something highly ordered as actually a response to more efficiently create entropy. This whole notion is something that's really important in my work because it actually allows us to understand entropy production as something generative and constructive. And actually, we can understand a lot of cosmic complexification and the various levels of it as emerging out of these deep dynamics, and that's a really promising line of inquiry, I think. But more what you were saying made me think of sort of something like Edge of Chaos kind of discussions, or the way that constraints can generate greater degrees of freedom, which is also a point that Harari talks a lot about in her book, because it's not so much I would say, that. I guess the way I tend to look at things is we're looking for the maximal complexity before things become chaos, right? And so if you have certain metrics, like I think it's called algorithmic or Kolmogorov complexity, where actually the greater you approach, in a sense, ultimate randomness, that's kind of the axis along which increasing complexity flows. But we wouldn't say that a totally random number is a very complex thing, right? That's not high in information, just randomness. If it's all just the same number, let's say 1111111111, infinitely, that's a very simple and orderly thing, but that's not very complex at all. And so what we actually find is that complexity is sort of in between these extremes of sort of ultimate randomness and ultimate order. And that's where the really good stuff happens in evolutionary dynamics and in other kinds of processes, whether that's our brains. I was just seeing actually today, I think Sabina, what's her name? Hossenfelder?
Felder.
She put out a video where another study was talking about the brain as operating at this edge of complexity or edge of chaos. Sorry. What I would suggest is maybe something like what we're really looking for is the optimal degrees of freedom that a set of constraints can bring without either being too overbearing or too loose, such that you actually lose capacities. So, for example, one thing that Hararo talks about in her book is something like a government system that has certain laws and rules and that sort of thing, or you could say traffic patterns or rather traffic rules. What these things are constraints, but they actually generate certain kinds of things that wouldn't be possible without them, right? So, like having a certain kind of orderly functional road system or a functioning harmonious kind of civic society, right? Like it's through the imposition of constraints that you actually get higher levels of kind of complexity, and I think that what we want to do is find that optimal in itself, a kind of equilibrium between that, so that people can feel like they're getting what they need relative to a worldview, but still able to engage other people's worldviews. And so, if you're like too, if you're too, let's say, if the constraints are too tight on your own level of thinking, that's going to inhibit that kind of degree of freedom. But if you're too open, then you don't have a worldview. It's just chaos, right? So there are many ways in which we can understand that. I think the dynamics that you were describing there, in terms of order and complexity, or let's say order and chaos, and the kind of being on the edge of chaos is sort of that optimal, thriving, highly adaptive, kind of space to be, for reasons that, we're getting at. So I know that's.
You think maybe that's why in this metamodern era the young people are returning to board games? Because board games have a set of rules, but and you couldn't play the game without the rules. But within the rules, you have all sorts of creative opportunities for strategy and connection and relationship with people while you're playing the game, right? And so creative play really requires rules. Just as, traffic rules and government rules and everything else. But then you have the maximum amount of freedom within that. And I noticed the other day that Jordan Peterson, in his talk with Joe Rogan, said that he's coming to the conclusion now that the optimal system for human beings is play. So kind of interesting. What were you going to say, Corey? I saw you light up as you had something to throw in here.
I've had a lot of thoughts pass through my mind listening to you both. Whenever chaos comes up, my brain always goes right back to this fact that chaology, the study of like randomness, like it started out as the study of chaos, and it eventually turned into the study of order. It just turned out that chaos was our inability to reflect on and understand a hidden order. that's too complicated for us to be able to understand yet. And of course, I would relate that to, behavioral complexification and the development of our intelligence. We just don't necessarily have yet developed the behavioral forms required or have applied ones that we have appropriately to what it is that we're looking at. And so it looks like a mess. It looks like chaos. But once we are able to see the order, then it looks entirely different, and and then we see the patterns. And yeah, like in terms of the crystalline thing, like what Brendan said, crystals are very, very like structurally well ordered. Repetition of a pattern, that's what creates crystalline structure. But yeah, I'm just kind of keeping my eye on the time. I could go on more, but I don't want to push us too far
Yeah,
over.
I think that's a it's a really good place to end, I think, because we kind of wrapped it up in a great way. And if we have another opportunity to do this with the two of you, I would love that because I think that we there's some creative generation going on here in this Trio Locos. That's pretty interesting. And when you said that about hidden order, I thought, oh, there's lots to talk about there because we could get into the whole thing of hidden variables and David Bohm's theories, and the connection that you both are making between science and spirituality, which we didn't touch on at all this time. So I think that would be a profitable move for the next time around. But I want to thank you both for joining me. And I never tell people this, I always forget at the beginning. If you do hit the subscribe button and like the video, it really does help get more people's eyes on it. But anyway, thank you guys. It was great.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Bye-bye.